From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Washington, D.C. today at NPR's election headquarters.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And here we are, what Walt Whitman called America's Choosing Day. And Americans are making a choice in droves, lines around the block at polling places. Here's what some voters said as they cast ballots in Cleveland and Philadelphia.
It seems like there's been a few races where I'm not voting for someone, I'm voting against someone. And I really felt like I didn't have someone I could really be behind and be for.
I kind of wish I could have voted for President Obama, but, I mean, I was too young. I'm happy I'm able to contribute to history because it's going to be our first woman president, so it's exciting.
Definitely glad that it's over. I mean, just the hype about it, and I thought it was a complete joke this time around.
Yeah, it's a real tough one this year, you know, but I think I made the right decision. I stayed up late last night, again, watching Trump on his final hours, and it was very impressive, you know.
Well, to start, that was Adrian Halcombe in Cleveland, Tiffany Brown in Philadelphia, and Damaris Torres and Linda Strongman in Cleveland. Jeremy, the National Voter Helpline Election Protection is reporting just a few problems. Voting machine glitches causing long lines in three precincts in Virginia. A handful of precincts in Durham County, North Carolina, election monitors had to bring out the paper roll books because there were problems with the computer check-in system. And in Utah, election officials say all of Washington County started the day voting with paper ballots after a computer problem there.
Although it looks like everything went fine for the candidates when they voted today in New York, Hillary Clinton in Chappaqua.
I know how much responsibility goes with this, and so many people are counting on the outcome of this election, what it means for our country, and I'll do the very best I can if I'm fortunate enough to win today.
Donald Trump phoned into Fox News before he cast his ballot in New York City.
I do think a lot of the polls are purposely wrong. I think I can almost tell you by the people that do it. The media is very dishonest, extremely dishonest, and I think a lot of the polls are phony.
NPR's Scott Detrow is in New York, where both candidates will be watching results come in tonight. Hi, Scott.
Happy Election Day.
It's finally here. Well, we're seeing some very big lines at polling places in the swing states. We talked about New Hampshire, but also in places like California. What are we seeing in terms of turnout today?
Well, I think, I mean, you always get the big picture numbers at the end of the day, but certainly anecdotally, certainly stories people are sharing online. It's a lot of lines in a lot of places. I mean, this looks like for all of the talk that we've heard all year, and you heard with some of those voters that were in the clip a moment ago, for all the negative feelings about this race, it does seem so far in terms of what we're seeing this morning and also early voting totals to be bringing people to the polls to participate in it.
And are you seeing a connection between early voting and the long lines, depending on where it has been restricted or where it's been more available?
You know, I think that was certainly a story, specifically in North Carolina. That's a state that saw a lot of restrictions on early voting sites, how many there were per county. That was a big political battle and a big court battle. And a lot of frustration from Democrats, feeling like even though Democrats did have overall solid numbers in North Carolina in the early vote, they felt like African-American communities especially were hurt by a lack of sites, and that's one reason why African-American voting figures were down. So I think the thing to watch is today what sort of numbers come in when there are many more polling sites open across the state.
Well, staying with the idea of early voting, let's take a look at Florida. We know a record 6.5 million people in Florida voted early, 39.8% votes cast by Democrats, 38.4% by Republicans. So very tight there. Yeah. The Democrats lead by 89,000 or so votes and a 1.4% margin. But in 2012, they led by almost three times the percentage in the early voting. So again, I'm assuming people are going to be looking at the turnout today. And just remind us, you know, we always say, oh, you have to win Ohio or you have to win Florida. Does a candidate have to win Florida this year to win this election?
You know, it depends on the candidate. Donald Trump, I think it's safe to say, absolutely needs to win Florida to become president. It's near impossible without him winning Florida for that to happen. Hillary Clinton certainly wants to win Florida. She's worked very hard to win Florida. If she does, that puts her in an excellent position to win the White House. She could conceivably win the White House without Florida and even without Ohio this year, which would certainly be remarkable given the states that we typically focus on. But the early vote in Florida has been really fascinating to watch. Democrats do have that margin. Overall, the state has just seen a surge of early voting. More people have already voted in Florida before this morning than had in the entire 2000 election, which is really astounding to think about. And the thing to remember with those partisan margins there is that there's a huge chunk, millions of Florida voters who are unaffiliated with either party right now. So that's the big wild card. Hmm.
There are these new tools this year, like VoteCaster. We've been talking about them on the show that can give you kind of real-time look at what's going on. I'm kind of skeptical of them, I have to say,
yeah.
Scott, because
yeah.
there's no history. We don't know. And frankly, I took a look at it today. I don't know what I'm looking at, how many votes it should be or how many it shouldn't be. But what about that? What would you advise people as they see kind of numbers coming out throughout the day?
You know, I'm obsessed with the data when it comes to figuring out what's going on in this election. I've been staring at the early voting figures from all these key states for weeks, but I think I'm with you on that. I would view these sites that are putting information out there today with a massive grain of salt. I think it can be interesting to see who's turning out where. But I think, you know, like we said at the beginning, you don't know who's voted till the end of the day. So a snapshot at 10 o'clock is much different than a snapshot at 4 o'clock. And there's a lot of uncertainty there. So certainly, look at it if you want to. Certainly don't take any clear takeaways from this information at this point in the day.
No.
That's NPR's Scott Detrow, who will be covering the campaigns tonight, both of them in New York City. So easy to cover them both. Scott, we'll be watching. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
And we just have a reminder off that last note that at 10:30 a.m. in 2012, President Obama's team thought he was losing because of what the polling showed. So keep that in mind. Churches across the country have begun a new tradition, Election Day prayer services, to help voters heal from pretty divisive campaign. Now, some are simply providing day-long space for meditation. Others are offering full services with communion. The Reverend Megan Clapp is with the McLean Baptist Church in McLean, Virginia. Reverend Clapp, what's the goal of your service?
Is to come together and remember that it's not our politics that define us, which during this season, it feels a lot like it has been, but instead to remember that it is our faith and that it is our love. And that's where we draw our hope and our strength.
And this kind of election prayer service has been a longstanding tradition in some other churches. I'm thinking of the Episcopal Church. They actually have prayers in their Book of Common Prayer. I'm looking at a couple of them. As we move toward the election of new leaders for the United States, may we all join in a season of prayer, committing to offer to God our fears and frustrations, our hopes and dreams. Here's another one. O Lord, our governor, bless the leaders of our land, that we may be a people at peace among ourselves and a blessing to other nations of the earth. Do you have anything within the Baptist Church that's specifically about praying for the leaders of a country?
Well, as Baptists, so the service that we're putting together actually will use some elements from the Book of Common Prayer, as well as the Worship Source Book and the Iona Community Prayers. So it's a very ecumenical gathering of materials together, which very much reflects how we as Baptists are people of freedom. And in that sense, we may not have a set prayer book, but we are pulling together many, many resources from different ecumenical traditions.
Some churches are using poems so that even people who don't believe in a faith can feel a refuge. Talk about the importance of a refuge. What are you hearing about parishioners? What's happening among them, between them?
Well, I think the biggest thing is wanting our church to still be a sanctuary. So we're choosing to do this not today on Election Day, but tomorrow. And the idea is that a sanctuary is a place where you can come and fully be yourself. This will not be a service where some people are celebrating and other people feel like they're having a funeral because the candidate they were rooting for didn't win. But instead, this is a place where we come together and we can be truly ourselves and sit in peace and in love and just be with each other.
Well, they'll be on both sides of the aisle, but it's sounding like in your church, they're perhaps on both sides of the political aisles as well. Some churches might have people who are like-minded, but you're saying you have people who might be voting differently and you want to bring them together.
We do, and we have several members of our congregation who are very active in both parties, but some outlying parties as well, and they're very verbal about that. And our church really, in a sense, kind of prides itself on having Sunday school discussions. We had a event this summer in the home of a member where we met with the Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty and talked about how do we live out our faith in this area of high political tension, but also how do we be involved to be a prophet in a sense to what's going on in our country. So there are people who are very vocal on either sides, but we really want to foster being able to have loving discussions in that and respecting each other, no matter what our leanings may be.
Well, Reverend Clapp, good luck to us all in that effort. That's the Reverend Megan Clapp, the minister to youth and young adults at McLean Baptist Church in McLean, Virginia. They're planning an election prayer service for tomorrow. We'll have some details at hereandnow.org. But churches across the country are doing this today, tomorrow, and into the future. Reverend Clapp, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And another revived tradition, Election Day cakes. Maybe you've seen the hashtag Make America Cake Again. This all started after the revolution, women baking cakes to get people to vote and to remind them this is fun. So this year, some bakeries are offering these bundt cakes. Proceeds go to the League of Women Voters. You can make your own. Make America Cake Again. We'll post ours at hereandnow.org. It's Here and Now. An election takes place. The Cubs win, but nothing seems to impact the death toll in Chicago. This past weekend, 4 men were killed by gunfire. 15 more were wounded. Halloween weekend, the tally was 6 dead, 15 wounded. October was Chicago's second most violent month this year. 78 murders, 353 shootings. And those statistics come despite an innovative program being used by the Chicago Police Department to determine who's likely to commit a violent crime or die in one, to then find them and try to save their lives or the lives of their potential victims. It's an algorithm, but looking at the statistics, it doesn't seem to be working. Frank Main has covered crime for the Chicago Sun-Times for years and says that the violence in Chicago is as bad now as it was when he started 17 years ago. He joins us from the newsroom at the Sun-Times. Frank, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And start with the algorithm. Tell us a little more about it, who was behind it, and how it was supposed to work.
So this was a long time coming, and there's a particular fellow who had a lot to do with it. His name is Andrew Papachristos. Back in 2002, I met him because he was working at the National Gang Crime Center and was out in the street doing research on gangs. And so as far back as 2010, he and some other researchers started looking at Chicago and trying to see whether they could apply kind of network strategy to solving crime in Chicago.
Well, this is just fascinating to us because not only was he a guy from Chicago, his mother dealt with gangs. She was a social worker. You know, it sounds like, you know, a Chicagoan who really almost crafted his career to try to help this problem.
That's true. And so he looked at this thing a couple different ways. And one of them was that he went to the west side of Chicago and he saw that there was a very small number of people who were in a network of individuals who are at super high risk of getting killed. So essentially, he looked at a neighborhood that had about 80,000 people in it, and he found a network of about 1,600 people who were at the highest risk of getting murdered. And he found, you know, just like in 6 degrees of separation, he found that many of these people were a handshake away from their killers. I mean, they knew the people who were likely to kill them. They were in, you know, a high-risk lifestyle. And what was interesting about his research there is that some people wrote off these entire communities as being dangerous and, you know, everybody in the community was at high risk of being killed. So he said, well, if we really drill down into these neighborhoods, maybe we can apply some strategies to save those people.
This led to what's now called the strategic subject list. And your police chief there agrees, your police superintendent, Eddie Johnson, he says, we know there's a small segment that's driving this, which
that's
was,
right.
You know, off of this research.
But the history actually goes back to 2013. The previous police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, actually launched this thing. And he kind of created a hybrid of what Andrew Papachristos wanted to do. He used it to also identify potential offenders, so people who might shoot and kill other people. And so they tried to create this, like you said, strategic subject list based on an algorithm that would use all sorts of factors to try to predict, you know, who was most likely to engage in violence, as well as who might be a victim.
Well, talk about some of those factors, because it's not race and it's not neighborhood. It's things like what? Arrests and convictions?
So Some of the things that might make you at risk would be that you had a previous violent crime in your background or violent crimes. You might be a gang member. You might be in a certain age group right. that might be more likely to commit violence. The thing is about this particular algorithm that the university that designed it and the Chicago Police Department won't talk specifically about what's in the algorithm. They'll talk generally about what it does.
And when you say the person who designed it, Miles Wernick is a professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He created the algorithm again off of Andrew Papakristos at Yale's research. Okay, so when it's first drawn up, just start there. A lot of people worried about this. It seems like it's targeting somebody for a crime they haven't committed.
Right, future crime, right? So it really raised a lot of eyebrows when they first talked about this. But what it really does is it has allowed the police to knock on a very small number of doors of people who they believe are at the highest risk of either being killed or killing somebody.
Okay, tell us about that part of the program. The police commander visits people pinpointed by the algorithm to tell them the risk they're at. How's that working?
The last time I addressed this issue was a couple months ago, and I was told that since 2010 they had essentially made contact with about 950 people who were gang members and were on this SSL list. So if you think about that, I mean, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the total number of gang members in Chicago, which, you know, are estimated at least 100,000 in Chicago. The people who run this program, of course, believe that this is working, and they say about 11% of these people that they met with became victims of a shooting after one of these visits. So in other words, you know, 1 in 10 did not become victims. They also said that 20% of the people that they contacted committed a new act of violence. So, you know, 2 in 10 committed an act of violence. And then 19% of these people reached out for help. So the third component of this program is to have people who they consider to be influential in your life, like your pastor or your coach or somebody who you respect, also at the door with the police commander and offering to get you help in terms of job, counseling, services, that kind of thing. And, you know, not everybody takes them up on that. And in fact, in talking to people who have actually been visited by these folks, a lot of these young guys tell me that they were kind of wary of what the police were up to. You know, they thought that they were essentially just being targeted by the police instead of being offered a helping hand. So there's still a lot of distrust. So what's happening now, I mean, with these 600-plus murders that are going on right now in Chicago is that there are a whole host of different reasons why that's happening. And this program, I would have to say, is just one small way to address it, you know?
Well, later this week, we're going to explore those other factors, including how many gangs there are in Chicago. Wow, 100,000 members. That's Frank Main, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, who covers crime. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we'll take another look on Thursday at the bigger problems relating to gun violence in Chicago. But if you live there, we want to hear what you think they are. Please leave a comment with this story at hereandnow.org.
Well, earlier this year, the University of Texas marked 50 years since the first public mass shooting on a U.S. college campus. In August 1966, Charles Whitman, a student at UT Austin, killed 17 people and wounded 30 others. Most of his victims were shot from Whitman's perch on top of a 27-story tower on the campus. Well, now an Austin-based filmmaker has found a new way to tell that story through an animated documentary. Laura Rice from Here and Now contributor Texas Standard reports.
A cartoon of a shooting massacre sounds garish and macabre, but the film Tower is not that at all. The animation is lifelike and understated, and the stories are real.
Deciding to make the film animated was literally the very first decision I made after deciding to make the film.
Keith Maitland is the film's director.
And it's because the visceral nature of these firsthand stories that we're trying to tell in Tower are so personal and they're so rooted in time and space and with a point of view that I just wanted to make sure we could capture that in a way that audiences could really put themselves there.
Maitland says animation also allowed for an intimacy in telling parts of the story that he wouldn't have been able to otherwise achieve. That intimacy is also part of the reason he chose to tell the story through just a handful of voices.
You know, you have to realize there are literally thousands of eyewitnesses to this, you know, traumatic event. And all of those people have a story to share. You know, there's so many different facets to the tower shooting, but we knew we couldn't cover all of them. So we decided to focus on 8 specific voices of people who were right in the heart of the shooting.
I just remember looking up at the sky. It was so blue. And just thinking, I guess this is it.
The film screened at festivals all over the world and is now in limited release across the country. Maitland says he's found it has broad appeal.
When people all around the country heard about the shooting live as it was unfolding on their local news, it really captured America's interest and curiosity. So I think there's an entire generation or two of people out there who grew up knowing just a little bit about the shooting.
But what may explain the interest even more is what's happened since the August 1st, 1966 shooting. Many more school shootings.
You know, every week we turn on the news and this shooting has played out in one form or another in cities across America and across the world. But what the tower shooting offers that Newtown or Columbine or whatever the shooting that happens next week can't offer is 50 years of perspective.
And Maitland says we've learned we can't push these events, as ugly as they are, under the rug.
You know, one of the biggest themes that always comes out in the film is how people just didn't talk about this shooting in the years afterwards. Austin didn't have much of a relationship to it. The university hasn't had much of a relationship to it. And people in audiences all over the country just really can't relate to that. And they ask me, why do I think that is? Now we know you need to talk about things like this. And that's what the film's about.
Tower will be in select theaters across the country through January. It's also slated to be featured on PBS stations early next year. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Rice.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Elections make history. Today's will as well. But this particular election day date has been a big one over the years. Here's now, Here and Now's Alex Ashlock takes a look.
In 1864, the U.S. had endured 3 years of bloody civil war. Thousands of Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing in action that summer alone. Thousands of Confederates were dead as well. But that fall, Union General William Tecumseh Sherman seized Atlanta, and Union forces scored other victories on the battlefield. That helped President Abraham Lincoln win re-election over George McClellan, the former commander of the Army of the Potomac.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
In 1932, millions of Americans were out of work. The country in the depths of its worst depression. Republican Herbert Hoover was the incumbent president. New York Governor Franklin Roosevelt won the Democratic nomination and promised a new deal for the American people. On November 8th, he won in a landslide, the first of a record 4 terms.
The expenditures of cities and states and the federal government must be reduced in the interest of the nation as a whole. I believe that there are many ways in which such reduction of expenditures can take place, but I am utterly unwilling that economy should be practiced at the expense of starving people. We must economize in other ways. But it shall never be said that the American people have refused to provide the necessities of life to those who, through no fault of their own, are unable to feed and clothe and house themselves.
November 8, 1960 saw one of the closest elections in American history.
So, in nine states in the Middle West, Nixon has won 90 electoral votes. In two states, Kennedy has won 33. He's leading in two more states with 38, but a vital and elusive 38 electoral votes that haven't come in yet. That's the story.
Massachusetts Senator John F. Kennedy was a Democratic candidate. Vice President Richard Nixon was the Republican nominee. Their campaign featured the first televised presidential debates. Kennedy won the popular vote by just over 100,000.
The election may have been a close one, but I think that there is general agreement by all of our citizens that a supreme national effort will be needed in the years ahead to move this country safely through the 1960s. I ask your help in this effort, and I can assure you that every degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the long-range interests of the United States and to the cause of freedom around the world.
The 1988 presidential campaign ended on this date with Republican Vice President George H.W. Bush easily defeating Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. Speaking in front of a banner that read, "America Wins," Bush delivered his victory speech that night.
A campaign is a disagreement, and disagreements divide. But an election is a decision, and decisions clear the way for harmony and peace. And I mean to be.
Right now, millions of Americans are expressing their decisions at the polls. They're writing a new chapter in American history. We should have the first draft soon. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
All right, let's take a break from election coverage for just a minute for a country edition of the DJ Sessions.
Country can be in the middle of the city.
Oft I sing,
oft I sing,
for my friends.
For my friends.
Didn't mean to let you know. Didn't mean to tell you so.
Marcia Campbell joins us now. She hosts the WSM All-Nighter on WSM Radio in Nashville, Tennessee, and she's back with us. Marcia, welcome.
Thank you so much, and I'm so honored to be welcomed back and working with you, Jeremy. That's always a sweet treat.
It's always nice to have you, and I remember that you were the one who introduced us a few years ago to Chris Stapleton, who became a huge celebrity, and we heard about him for the first time on the DJ Sessions.
Yay! So far, I'm doing pretty good. Chris Stapleton.
Yeah, good track record. Let's get to one of the first bands you wanted us to hear from. This is the Grammy-nominated Nashville group The Time Jumpers, who have a new album. This is called My San Antonio Rose.
I can't wait to get back to my San Antonio Rose.
Everyone in Texas knows I love him from his head down to his toes.
Well, I hope I haven't stayed away too long.
And I hope that he's not dancing to somebody else's song.
I can't wait to get back to my San Antonio Rose.
And you've got a personal connection to this song. Tell us about that.
I do. One of Nashville's musical treasures, as you said, the Grammy-nominated group, The Time Jumpers, with their third album, Kid Sister, on Rounder Records. It's a new and classic song and celebration of country and western music, the traditional music style. Most importantly, it's a sweet tribute to the band's late girl singer, Dawn Sears. Kid Sister, the title of the album. Dawn Sears recorded and toured with Vince Gill for over 20 years, so she was his kid sister. Hmm. Vince Gill being a member of the Time Jumpers, he wrote that song, Kid Sister, as a tribute to Dawn Sears. My San Antonio Rose, that is a duet with Dawn Sears and her husband, Kenny Sears. Dawn Sears passed away December 11th, 2014, due to lung cancer at the age of 53. Hmm. That's the day I lost my best friend.
Oh, we're sorry to hear that. And you knew her very well.
Absolutely. We toured together, worked together, traveled together. She was my sister. And I do miss her. But with this album, which they were in the process of making, she was sick, she was taking treatments, and she fought the disease ferociously and championed efforts for cancer research. And we are so thankful to have Dawn's voice on this project, again with her husband Kenny Sears on My San Antonio Rose.
Well, let's listen to Kid Sister here, the song you've been talking about, by the Time Jumpers.
Dawn, those angels, they've got you good. Say hello to your new world. As heaven's about to unfurl, and you'll suffer no more. We're all coming someday. How the old band will play. We'll gather, kid, sister, and sing on that beautiful show.
So this is the tribute to Dawn Sears.
Mm-hmm. And he just says, Dawn, those angels are with you. I can only imagine how big her angel wings are. He's talking and singing about Sweet Memories I Carry With Me. Sweet Memories was one of the songs nominated for a Grammy on an earlier project by the Time Jumpers, and Sweet Memories was sung by Dawn Sears.
All right, well, up next, you wanted us to hear from a group out of Murfreesboro, which is not far from Nashville. This is the bluegrass group Flat Lonesome. This is You're the One.
You're the one.
Kind of a vindictive message there, Marcia.
I know, and you may remember that was a hit for Dwight Yoakam. He wrote and recorded the song, had a hit on the song in 1991. Well, in January of 2011, Kelsey, Charlie, and Buddy, brother and sisters, they teamed up with Dominic, Michael, and Paul, and they became Flat Lonesome. Since then, the group has been awarded numerous awards. They are fan favorites at the Grand Ole Opry. They have received multiple standing ovations. So, simply amazing. They're in their 20s, and they're singing like that. And I love family harmony.
Well, and do you hear a lot of family groups coming through these days in the country scene?
Not enough. Not enough. There are some, you know, family groups still traveling around supporting bluegrass or country music, but we need more. I mean, we had the Leuven Brothers and the Osborne Brothers, so I think we can always use more family harmony.
All right, well, we have time for one more, and this is an Alabama native, artist Bradley Walker. This is Call Me Old Fashioned.
I believe in making my money the hard way, so I work for it. And every job I do with pride. And I believe in keeping a promise that I've made. You've got my word on it when I shake your hand and look you in the eye. And I believe in Old Glory, putting your hand over your heart and taking off your hat when that anthem starts. Call me old-fashioned, call me out of touch for having faith in the way it was when a mom and pop was the place you'd shop and a check was good for cashing.
So he's singing about being old-fashioned, although he's in his 30s, and by the way, has been in a wheelchair his whole life. He's got muscular dystrophy.
Yes, Bradley Walker has been in a wheelchair for over 30 years now due to muscular dystrophy. And when asked if he thinks life has been unfair to him, he answers with he feels sorry for the hardworking mother raising children on her own. He feels sorry for the one who has to call a cold underpass home, or all the lonely people out there who cannot find a friend. That's just a reflection of who Bradley Walker is. Call Me Old Fashioned reflects Bradley's love of tradition, while another song on the album, Sinners Only, it's a reminder we're all just sinners saved by grace. Now that he's signed to Gaither Music Group with a new album and a concert DVD, the best kept secret in country music is on the brink of becoming a household name.
Is there anyone he reminds you of?
I hear the Vern Gosden, and I hear the Merle Haggard, and I hear the Gene Watson. Those are some of my musical heroes as well. I've known Bradley for years, and he still has his day job at working at a nuclear power plant, and he drives his custom van back and forth to Nashville. He's written songs. He's made meetings all these different years of traveling and coming to Nashville. He has the respect of the musicians, singers, and songwriters here in Music City.
Well, Marcia Campbell, host of the WSM All-Nighter on WSM Radio in Nashville. Always great to have you on the DJ Sessions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a little different, traditional sounding this time, but it's always an honor to be with you, and I wish you happiness and good health. Godspeed, my friend.
And the same to you. And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
Just in time for the holidays, fake mobile apps on their way to an iPhone near you, probably yours. Hundreds of these fake apps, masquerading as brands you know well, have popped up in the Apple App Store in the last few weeks. The scam sends pop-up ads to unsuspecting downloaders, but could do much worse than that. Apple's removed many of them, but hasn't done enough for some critics. So let's check in now with our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. And joining us from San Francisco, Ina Fried, senior editor of mobile at Recode. Ina, happy Election Day.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And first, walk us through this. What do these apps look like, and how do you even know what they are if they look the same as other legitimate apps?
Well, they're subtly different. So one of these, for example, said Foot Locker, like Foot Locker, but without the R. So, you know, these aren't necessarily high-quality fakes, but they are duping some people into thinking they're the real thing. And when you download them, you know, again, you should notice pretty quickly if an app is popping up stuff and just delete it. You know, this is a problem. It's not a huge problem, but it is a problem. Apple is taking notice. They're trying to figure out some things. But like a lot of things like security, this is an arms race. And, you know, they figure out something and then the bad guys figure out something else to sneak it past.
Well, when you say when you download it, you know, it'll show something and so you should just delete it. I'm thinking of a kid I know who would be clueless about this. But it's supposed to, when you download this fake app, it's one thing to notice spelling, but it'll have a pop-up ad maybe on your phone?
So when you open these apps, I mean, typically somebody doesn't do a fake app just to have fun. I mean, that happens occasionally. In general, what they're trying to do is either get your information or get you to buy stuff or show you advertising that they can make money from. There are some ways, though, to make sure this really doesn't happen to you. We can talk about both what to do if you figure out you've done it, which is delete the app. But actually, if you want, say, Foot Locker's app, go to Foot Locker's website and search for the app there. It's going to take you a link directly to the app store.
Yeah.
Or if you want to go through the app store, look at the reviews. Does it have a bunch of reviews that are positive? It's probably not fake.
Yeah. If it just says Jimmy liked it, you know, maybe not good. But you say, okay, so it might send you an ad and try to sell you something. But can it do something much worse? Can it send malware? Can it get in and take your information?
Well, the iPhone is pretty sophisticated against malware. So, I mean, theoretically, yes. But, you know, Apple is both checking for malware. I mean, that's kind of the one thing they're most focused on. The reason these got through is because fake shopping apps weren't actually first on their list. You know, it's a mix of Apple not being quite vigilant enough in some cases. And then also, as long as you create an app that connects to the web, you can actually change things on the server side. And not to get too techie, but the app itself might not be malicious, but it then gets changed over the internet to go to different websites. Suddenly you have a whole different app. In general, I don't think we're seeing a ton of harm being done here, but, you know, this isn't good. Apple clearly takes it seriously and is going to figure out ways to get better, but so are the bad guys.
What's it doing right now? And by the way, is it this just on iPhones and Apple or others?
No, actually, I mean, that's the surprising thing here is, you know, Google's Android App Store is known for being much more lax. Apple touts the fact that all apps are reviewed before they go online. Google has actually stepped up what it does. It uses automation versus humans, but they've gotten pretty sophisticated. You'll still find more sketchy stuff for Android, but Google's gotten better, and clearly in this case, Apple wasn't good enough. So, you know, it still pays for the downloader, I was going to say the buyer beware, but the downloader to beware of what they're downloading. And, you know, if you look in the App Store and you do a search and you pull up, you know, something that's got an editor's choice or a lot of reviews, you're probably going to be fine.
Yeah, because there are,
or again, go to the website of the app right. You want and click on their link.
Because there's hundreds of thousands of apps. So, and by the way, you know, we know how technology works. It's whack-a-mole. As soon as companies, like if Apple figures out how to block the bad apps, there's going to be an end run at some point. So just be a smarter user, as you say.
Yeah, and a few people can do a lot of damage. So in this case, there were hundreds of apps, but there's probably, you know, 8 or 9 really smart people in China that were doing most of this.
Right.
So a small number of people can, you know, do a lot of harm on the internet. And, you know, it's tough to outsmart smart people when they're trying to do bad things.
There you go. That's a bumper sticker waiting to happen. Ina Fried, Senior Editor of Mobile at Recode. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And as we wrap up the hour, Jeremy, you're there at the NPR headquarters in Washington. Can you feel the excitement building?
You know, it's funny. There's always a strange calm on election days, like the calm before the storm. I think later tonight it is going to be very exciting. I will say, Robin, that the stickers that say I voted on them that people wear, they're much bigger in D.C. than they are elsewhere.
We'll have to investigate that.
Like twice or three times the size.
I love when people wear them on their forehead.
Yeah.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. In the Eye of the Storm, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.